Howdy, everyone. Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio, a companion to the Guerrilla History Podcast. I'm your co-host, James, a member of the Guerrilla Radio Partisan Brigade, which is just a fancy way of saying I co-host from time to time. Today, I'm excited to be able to jump into a topic that I think is absolutely fascinating with a colleague and friend who notably has a podcast of his own that I think y'all should really dive into, called the Preoccupation Podcast, which delves into the history of historic Palestine and at times even surrounding countries like Lebanon before the advent of Zionist occupation. But before I really start getting into it more and really start just going into a bunch of details that I really like about what all's going on about this topic, let's delve into introductions.
All right. Good morning, James. And I'm not just a friend, but I'm also a fan of James and his work. So this is really exciting for me. You will also notice that my speaking speed is nowhere near his. So you'll have to get used to that. My podcast is called Preoccupation, a Not-So-Brief History of Palestine. And it started out as an attempt, like many Palestinians, an attempt to chronicle and record our family history and my family stories. And so I began with an interest in trying to just get a little bit of context about the world of my grandparents and the world of my great-grandparents. And now, hundreds and hundreds of hours later, I am very much deep into the Ottoman and Mandate history of Palestine. I think that's a reasonable place to start. I think I'll stop there for now.
Yeah, absolutely. Which, by the way, thank you for the putting of the hundreds of hours in, because over Ramadan, I stopped listening to music. So it's been a really nice hell to have so much to go through in the period.
Well, I'm glad. I'm glad. There is more on the way, but I'm glad it's been enjoyable.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, diving in, I mean, you know, you started off by talking about how, you know, a really core push of what all you had been trying to achieve with the podcast and with a lot of other associated efforts, it really is this understanding of history and this understanding of really one's own history and how it, you know, ties into, I think, a grander narrative, a grander understanding of where one comes from and what one's people really, for lack of better words, like, where the one's roots really lie, I think.
Right.
And, you know,
right.
Let me dive into the topic of today. You know, we're talking about the complexity of telling the Palestinian story, moving beyond counter-Hasbara. So I guess like a good starting point for us is, what do you feel is wrong with the way the Palestinian story is usually told? And what do you mean when you talk about moving beyond counter-Hasbara?
So when I really started to get into this, and of course, like many Palestinians, Palestinian history is made up huge part of my life, and just trying to understand who we are and where we come from and where my family comes from, all of those things, that's been a core part, not just of my adult life, but of my upbringing. But most Palestinian history is not actually a history of the Palestinian people. Most Palestinian history is what I could call the Palestinian experience with Zionism. At best, most Palestinian history is just that. It is Zionism from a Palestinian perspective. But what I mean by that is that if you try to get into the history of Palestine, most of the books that you will find, most of the documentaries that you will find, most of the research that is published and that is produced is usually how Palestinians experience the Zionist settler colonial project. Now, there are a myriad of reasons of why that is the case, but the reality is that would be akin to telling the story of your life as recorded from the moment of your parents' divorce, or the moment of a horrific car accident, or the moment where everything went wrong. And we are so much more than that. And so that's what motivated me to start looking beyond the Zionist settler colonial project, to look beyond the British imperial project, and to start looking and trying to understand who the Palestinian people actually are. Now, there is a lot, even when these really well-intentioned efforts are pursued, there is a lot that I've found that has been, with all of the best intentions, unhelpful. Most Palestinian people have some understanding of their own past, but their access to their past, and I know this is a very long answer for a first question,
No, I like it. Yeah. I like it.
Okay. I'm glad. Their access to their past is usually dependent upon the charisma of the individual storyteller who has shared with them some piece of their past. Sometimes it is a grandparent, sometimes it is a parent, an aunt or an uncle, family friend, and someone who's really passionate about storytelling. Now, for Palestinians, storytelling is like a superpower. So we often have access to someone who has this charisma. But therein lies a pretty obvious problem. James, you know, you live in the United States, I live in Canada. I bet you have a base understanding of American history. You probably have a better understanding of American history than most people. Where do you think you developed your foundational understanding? Forget the, you know, the more nuanced elements, the most foundational elements of your understanding of American history. Where did you develop this?
I mean, it would be a combination of primary school and parents just giving kind of one-off stories based on what for themselves was, I think, fairly limited understandings of a lot of the history.
So, and your parents also attended kind of a system of standardized education where they developed
this element.
Okay. Well, Palestinians are both diasporic and stateless. Okay. So we don't have state institutions wherein we get to tap into our collective stories. We don't have central archives. We don't have grand libraries that have documented all of our, you know, reified, either digitalized or paper-based materials. We don't have any of this. So even if the individual storyteller tells a really, really articulate, really, really well put together narrative of the Palestinian experience, these stories are scattered all over the world, and it's very difficult to get a coherent idea of who the Palestinian people are. And so I've made that now my life's mission. That's basically it. That's the podcast and that's what I do.
Fair. I mean, that's a heck of a mission though. I mean, tying in all of those threads, making one kind of comprehensive narrative has to be a lot of work.
The facts are never the problem. I have found, despite the fact that only 2% of archival material, of Palestinian archival material, has ever been released from Zionist hands, 98% remains under lock and key, there is, in fact, a lot of information. So the facts are not the problem. The problem is putting it together in a coherent narrative. So we started out by speaking about what's wrong with the way the Palestinian story is told. For most of these charismatic storytellers, who I alluded to a few moments ago, their stories will only go back as far as their information will allow them, or their research will allow them. Well, the reality is that most of our best and brightest, this is a massive generalization, but I think it'll hold true, and I think it'll resonate with most of your listeners. As far as Palestinians are concerned, most of our best and brightest are doctors and engineers. Like the fact that I have a history podcast and I am a social studies teacher reveals the fact that I'm a deadbeat, like by Palestinian standards. I didn't cut it in the world of dentistry or I'm not a heart surgeon or like any of the things that I should be, right? Maybe our community is better for it. Still, we're still not sure yet. But if you are a heart surgeon or you're a civil engineer or you're a dentist or whatever it is, you might not actually have the skills or the time to be able to do the research to tell this really complex and nuanced story. And so moving beyond counter Hasbara is to move beyond simply a rebuttal of the Zionist version of the conflict or the Zionist version of our occupation and the Zionist version of our colonization. There is, in fact, a whole history of a people that predates Theodor Herzl's first heartbeats.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and I think that's really important too, like notably, because I agree with you. I think a lot of the framing that we get when we're talking about Palestine, we're talking about the history, it's all the history that is tied really intrinsically to the occupation itself. It's almost as if, like, for a lot of people, and I struggle with this as well at points, and historically did when even I was starting to research more about the occupation itself, is it seems that a lot of the framing really starts in 48, maybe if you're lucky, in 36. Maybe if you're even luckier and you've read a little bit further, 1917. But the truth of the matter is it goes well beyond that. I think a really good book that I've been delving through painstakingly, as it's a book that I've struggled to finish, is I think it's Palestine, a 4,000-year history, where it's a similar concept where you can go all the way back to the Roman times and really before to really understand the real depth and scope of the history of the region and the people who call it home. And I think we do ourselves a disservice, really, when we really hyperfixate on what is, in the grander span of time, this really small part of Palestinian history, even if it's incredibly important in the modern time. But nonetheless, it's such a small bit.
You know, one of the challenges that I have found is that even the materials that do go back into the Ottoman era kind of treat Palestinian history as a countdown to 1948. Now, what happens when you do that is you miss all of the other stories of what Palestine could have potentially been. And so it's not even just a matter of the starting point. It's also a matter of the focus, right? Are you just treating the Palestinian people as a people who are waiting to be colonized? And if so, you are really missing out on a lot of information that if your goal is to better discover yourself as a Palestinian, which was my goal, then that simply will not satisfy your learning journey. Now, as far as a masterful resource like Nur Masalha's Palestine, a 4,000-year history, that is a perfect example of the other, as a resource that explores other narratives around Palestine's past. There really are three main stories, and I've spoken about this before in other interviews. There are really three main stories that tie together Palestinian identity. One is a story of the land, and that's what Nur Masalha does. He's telling a story. He's telling a geographic, toponymic story of the land itself. Another story, the one that I am most interested in, is the story of emergence of a peoplehood, the story of the Palestinian national consciousness. When did Palestinians start to think of themselves as Palestinian? It's one thing to say, I live in Palestine, but it's a whole other thing to say, I am Palestinian. And the third story, the one that gets the most attention, which is very interesting, it's just not the most interesting to me, is the story of the national project. When did Palestinians begin pursuing an independent nation state? Or in lieu of a nation state, what other political projects were they pursuing? Now, pedagogically speaking, the way that I convey this to audiences and to students is the difference between these three stories is to say the story of the land is to say this is Palestine. The story of a people is to say I am Palestinian. And the story of a national project is to say Palestine belongs to me. The second one, the one in the middle, is the one that I'm the most interested in. But again, I go back to the point that unfortunately, there is not nearly enough written about the emergence of a Palestinian peoplehood.
You know, I think that's really interesting. And you know, I know that when I first really came into orbit with you and first really sat down and talked with you or heard a lecture from you, which I think it's notable that I'm also a very big fan of yours. You know, it was over the 36 revolt, over Al-Qassam, and really talking about the integral nature of that. But, you know, that was related still, I think, really to the more modern occupation, really, I think, leaning into that. Although I think it delved heavily into, you know, this idea that there's a larger history and themes that go into these things. You know, that being said, your podcast, I think, really stuck out to me in regards to how you tell the story of not just the land itself, because I think you really do a really good job of delving into the history of the land, not just in Palestine, but in Lebanon too. I've learned so many random things, I think, that I'm not random. They're very, very pointed, I think, intentional things to learn. But just understanding the broader history regionally that I think filters into the Palestinian story as well. You know, the idea of how even Christian evangelicals in Lebanon play an intrinsic role in developing material conditions that eventually affect Palestinians in the region. Things which I think could be an entire topic in and of itself, really. But to that end, like, you know, when you delve into your podcast materials, when I think you delve into the efforts of what you were trying to do
you really hit hard on the Ottoman period. And I'm curious as to what was the specific decision between kind of moving from the Zionist occupation to kind of the Ottomans and moving into that era for a focal point. It's just something that's always made me get a little curious.
That's a fantastic question. So I'll start by saying this. One of the fascinating things that I've learned in my now 4 or 5 years of doing this research, one of the fascinating things that I've learned is that you cannot truthfully and accurately tell the Palestinian story in a manner that is divorced from the Ottoman universe. Palestine was an organic part of the Ottoman whole. It was an organic part of the Mashriq, for sure, and the Ottoman whole in general, and the Mashriq being the Eastern Ottoman world. But in practical terms, as I tried to answer questions about, my family is from Jaffa, so as I tried to answer questions about why my family would have been in Jaffa, why my father's maternal grandfather was involved in transport, why his paternal grandfather would have been involved in the citrus industry, though they lived a huge chunk of their life in the Mandate era, I needed to go to the Ottoman era to get the answers to those questions. Because as I'm sure you can appreciate, right, the context that you live in is influenced by things that happened long before you were born. And what I discovered was that many of the things that existed in the Mandate era that the British took credit for was laid out in Ottoman infrastructure. So the British really took a ready-made project and then anglicized it. This is a big theme in what I've discovered. But I'm also trying in my more current episodes, I'm trying to move away gradually. I have not published any of these episodes yet. I've written them, but I have not published them. I'm also trying to move away from the Ottoman lens and to get a more local feel for what Palestinian life would have been like. So let me explain what I mean by that. I kind of broke down these three broad Palestinian stories. So in moving away from, in attempting to move away from the Ottoman story and to look more at a local context, what you discover is that despite the fact that there are these three meta-narratives of the story of the land, a story of a people, a story of a national movement, broken down further, you also have an Ottoman lens, you also have an urban lens, there is a peasant lens, and there is a Bedouin lens. And I can assure you that when you put any of these lenses on, you see a very different version of events. The urban Palestinians developed a connection with Palestine, developed a connection with each other, and arrived at a national movement in a way that is distinct from, but clearly overlaps with, peasant Palestinians. Mm. And peasant Palestinians experience that in a way that is unique and distinct from Bedouin Palestinians. And this has not made my life easier. It has certainly made things more interesting, but it has not made things, has not made telling the story easier. So In the earlier seasons, I focused on a really big Ottoman picture to kind of give the listener almost like a foundation into the world that existed, big political infrastructural foundation. And soon, inshallah, I want to get into more specific details about Palestinian urban and peasant and Bedouin life.
No, I think that's really fair. It brings me to a question too of like, how do you kind of parse through these? I mean, they're overlapping, but at times I have to assume contradictory narratives coming from different communities, different actors, different players, different material interests and movement and parts. And, you know, I think it has to be interesting. And I would assume at times difficult to really flesh through a lot of those contradictory sources, a lot of those different both positions and I guess perspectives. How do you go about maybe mapping that in a way that doesn't end up kind of sidelining maybe certain perspectives or what have you?
Oh my God, it drives me insane. I'll start with this. Every season that I'm now on my third season, And before any batch of episodes, I have plans of the kind of narrative that I'm pursuing. And what ends up happening is nothing even remotely close to what I had planned out. Because eventually I will let the facts just take me to where the story is leading, right? I'm not going to swim upstream and allow my preconceived notions of what that period was like to judge what my what the narrative should be like. I'd prefer to let it go the other way. And I actually rather enjoy, or I've grown to enjoy, the contradictory narratives surrounding the way that Palestinians dealt with the land and the way that Palestinians dealt with each other. I'll give you a simple example of this. This is a peek behind the veil into my next collection of episodes. All right. So most Palestinian cities in the late Ottoman era were walled cities. That's assuming that they weren't mountain cities. Some of the mountain cities didn't have walls, but particularly the coastal cities and places like Al-Quds, which was a mountain city. In any case, many Palestinian cities were walled. Some of those walls were in really good condition and served their purpose. Some of them were falling apart. Right. So the fact that these cities were walled indicates that they were trying to protect themselves from something.
Right.
So it turns out that they were trying to protect themselves from at least two things. One were wild animals. Okay. And those of us, you live in Philadelphia, I live in Vancouver, we are so thoroughly urbanized that we kind of forget the fact that until the very late stages of industrialization and capitalism, that wild animals pose a serious threat to like young children. And now we pose a threat to them. but for a very long time, they posed a very serious threat to us. But the other thing that these walls were trying to keep out were Bedouins. So from the perspective of an urban Palestinian, having grown up surrounded by these walls, there is this internal other that exists beyond these walls. Looked at from that perspective, you will find no shortage of books and no shortage of resources, and particularly resources from traveling missionaries that will portray the Bedouins as at best a noble savage, but at worst as purely motivated by violence and destruction. And so what I've tried to do very recently is to flip that and look at as much as I can. And I've been on a months-long binge just looking at Bedouins, just understanding Bedouin Palestinians.
I have to imagine that's a really fascinating angle or a really fascinating bit of information. Although I struggle, maybe this is just me not understanding the background here. Is it difficult to get archival records and actual written history and testimony of like Bedouin society? Like, I feel like it would be more difficult than like urban Palestinian populations, for example.
And more difficult than Bedouin Palestinians. Yes, the Bedouins were the least likely to document things from their own perspective. So my commitment is to try to get as many Bedouin voices as possible. Thankfully for me, some researchers in the 90s really invested a lot of time in archiving the oral history of Jordanian tribes. And this will lead into something that I'll say in a moment, but they spent a lot of effort in chronicling the oral histories and the family histories of Jordanian tribes, and have used that in partnership with the existing archival record to try to put together a story of where these tribes come from, where these families, what these families were motivated by, how they lived, and the picture that you get is a pretty lucid one. Now, woven into that, into what I just said, I think you noticed that I said Jordanian tribes. And the reality is that, to go back to something that I said earlier, if you treat these various nation states as distinct entities, you are doing the listener a disservice. The fact of the matter is that you found these tribes flowing on both sides of the Jordan River. You found the urban families married into the Damascus urban families. You found peasants traveling all around for religious pilgrimages, for commerce, for marriage, and so yes, while pursuing all of these various narratives is exhausting, it's very fruitful. So I have no regrets about trying to do that. I do wonder whether I will eventually hit a point where I need to start cutting threads. But I don't feel like I'm there yet.
I think that makes a lot of sense. I think with the Bedouin tale in particular, I know in your podcast, you, and correct me if I'm wrong here and misremembering, but you make a really big effort to say that, like, not only are these communities, whether they be urban Palestinians, whether they be, you know, rural peasantry, whether they be Bedouin Palestinians, though they have different interests, different motivations, they're all also intrinsically woven together in a kind of societal fabric that was dependent very largely on each one of them operating in a very certain way. And Bedouins play a major role in like the transit of goods, in the protection of goods, in the real armament, I guess, of the Palestinian communities.
Yes, absolutely. From season one, I make that I make that very clear. The truth of the matter is that if you want to tell a story of fratricide and conflict, the information is there.
Absolutely.
Massive tribal feuds and clan warfare and family rivalries. And I love those stories, but that is not the whole story. Ultimately, I desire to give Palestinians a dignified version of their past. With all of the embarrassments, in fact, I think the embarrassments give the story color and flavor, and it gives it depth and dimension. But dignified nonetheless.
Mm-hmm. Well, what would be an example of that then? I mean, it's something interesting. I think I agree. I think it also humanizes the narrative in a way that you don't otherwise get, just from like reading, like a very cold reading of just kind of the movements of these families and things of that nature. Maybe for the viewer's sake, what would be an example of that for you? Something notable.
Something notable is in terms of a dignified version, or something notable in terms of an embarrassment? Because I have both.
I'm definitely both.
Yeah. So here's an example of something unflattering, but very interesting. Okay. And it's very topical for what's happening in Palestine right now, and it relates to the city of Gaza. And in Gaza and its environs, the most dominant family was the Husseini family, not to be confused with the Quds Husseini family, another Husseini family. And Gaza was a major city. I mean, in late Ottoman Palestine, it had a population of about 20,000, which is enormous. And the Husseini family was not the only show in town. And a bunch of the other Gazan families colluded together and lobbied the Ottoman government to depose the head religious figure of the Husseini family, writing that he is an apostate, that he is a drunkard, that he is, like, he's all these terrible things, right? Mm-hmm. All these things that are, like, hyper-exaggerated and almost certainly were not actually true.
Just dragging him through the mud.
Yes, absolutely. Just taking his good name right through the mud and trying to rip the family apart. Now, it didn't work, but if your version of Palestine is that it was heaven prior to the Zionist colonization, you're a victim of imagined nostalgia. There were family rivalries. People lied about each other. People stabbed each other in the backs. People colluded with the Ottoman authorities against their neighbors. And the Ottoman authorities pinned families against each other. And sometimes these families cooperated with each other against the Ottoman authorities. So there's an example, right, of something that is, on the one hand, not the prettiest picture, but on the other hand, very interesting. Like, at least I think so.
No, absolutely.
And I think it does add some depth to the story. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, on the flip side of that, we have this long history of Bedouins being the source of violence. There is this narrative of the desert versus the sown, the idea that the mere presence of Bedouins was antithetical to settled life. On the other hand, there is no shortage, absolutely no shortage, of sources speaking about high levels of cooperation between Bedouins and peasant Palestinians for the purposes of trade, commerce, co-protection. There is no shortage of resources speaking about the relationships between specific Bedouin Palestinian families or Bedouin Palestinian tribes and the notables of either Jerusalem or the notables of Nablus. All of these things are there. So even though it takes more time, it's really fun to tell this complete picture of both conflict and cooperation between urban Palestinians and rural Palestinians and Bedouin Palestinians. For me, the ultimate teller of success is not how many downloads the podcast gets, because that's actually more determined by what's happening in the world at the time. A genocide in Gaza, in this perversion of reality, spikes my downloads through the roof. Right, people all of a sudden start paying attention when Palestinians are being massacred. So downloads are not the best indication of success for me. The greatest indication of success are the messages that I get from Palestinians around the world. So when Palestinians shoot me a message on Instagram and they tell me that my podcast has been very helpful in their personal learning journey, that's the best. That for me is the absolute best. My hope is that young Palestinians who are in high school or in university right now can benefit from my work, use that as a springboard to do something way better, way bigger. And it just goes on and on and on and on. Because like I said at the very beginning of this, we don't have a central archive. We don't have a Ministry of Education. We don't have a Ministry of Antiquities. All of these things not only do not exist, but what little does exist is under constant threat. Absolutely. For its very survival.
Well, and that brings me to another point too, to come back to something you had said, is that oftentimes, I think what you're doing in the efforts that you make and in the education that you are providing, presents a more holistic picture of Palestinian society as well. When we look at, if we were to say, just take the occupation in from even just 47 onward to now, we end up with two core problems. The one being what we've already discussed in depth, I think, which is that, you're essentially stripping Palestinian history of centuries of context, of interwoven connectedness, of struggle, of storytelling, what have you. But you're also simultaneously running into a potential problem, which you, I think, noted slightly a minute ago, which is you end up in a position where you could inadvertently, out of reaction to Hasbara, out of reaction to Zionist propaganda, fall into a trap of romanticizing, of creating this idealized version of what Palestine was in history. I think, we see Fanon talks about this a little bit, I think, in Wretched of the Earth, where you have this this potential for an over idealization of a society that strips it, I think, in this context, of a lot of really important context, and also helps inoculate the larger struggle from just being torn away by propagandistic talking points on the Zionist side. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are there.
Yeah, let's talk about counter Hasbara for a bit. Yeah. And when I say counter Hasbara, I really mean an effort to rebut, combat, and hopefully embarrass Zionists, right? Which is something you do very well. You are the gold standard of counter Hasbara. So let me start off by let me make this very clear. Somebody needs to do it, right? Like somebody needs to be out there doing this, and you are very, very good at what you do. I imagine that as a spiritual endeavor, it is soul crushing to do, because you're constantly listening to little versions of gobbles and rebutting the things that they've said, right? Or sometimes big versions of gobbles. I say, somebody needs to do it. I'm glad you're doing it. I'm glad it's not me. I'll start off with that. The worst version of counter Hasbara is when I hear Palestinians say things like, well, they are the Israelites and we are the Canaanites, or something stupid like this. which is basically to take Zionist history at face value and then to place yourself rather ahistorically into that wildly superficial and generally incorrect version of the past. Okay, that is the worst version of counter-Hasbara. More often, counter-Hasbara is, the Israelis say Palestine is a land without a people for a people without a land, when in actuality, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. The problem with all of this, and we have discovered it in this genocide, maybe more than any other chapter in Palestinian history, and you personally live this on a daily basis. It is so much easier to tell the lie than it is to dispel it. So, on some level, you, James, personally, must feel like a hamster in a wheel. Like, there is just so much misinformation. There are so many lies, and they could keep telling them over and over and over again, and tell new ones, and tell different ones. Me and a friend of mine share messages all day of every day of just Israeli headlines, right? Things from the Hebrew press about whatever's going on. And sometimes the Jerusalem Post, in the same day, James, in the same day, will post four or five totally contradictory messages. I'll give you an example. This is not just from the Jerusalem Post, but this is from like the Hebrew press in general. On the one hand, we'll have a source saying, Sinwar is the mastermind of everything that Hamas is doing right now. The logistics on the ground, where they're choosing to fight, where they're choosing to hold hostages and prisoners, and where they're choosing to move people, and where they're choosing to whatever. On the other hand, you'll have a narrative that says Sinwar has completely lost contact with the outside world. It's completely isolated. And I will send you this video. We'll send you this. So you don't think that it's not real. I will send you this. There was a man, I can't remember his name, yesterday giving a beautiful lecture to a very professional think tank somewhere. And he says, he's an Israeli, and he says, I'm in contact with the people on the ground, including Sinwar, and there is no famine in Gaza. Okay. So Sinwar is the mastermind of all the chess pieces on the ground. Sinwar has lost contact with even Ismail Haniyeh, but Sinwar somehow has access to this guy, right? This is nonsense, okay? These are totally contradictory claims. We're not even talking about history right now. We're talking about current events, right? Feeling the need to respond to all of these things. I'm glad someone is out there doing it. I just would never want it to be me. Now, by contrast, if I come and spend a few hours telling you about late Ottoman Jerusalem and the families that existed within it, and I tell you about the Bedouin tribes that lived on the frontiers and in the arid spaces, and I tell you about the families of Haifa, the religious dynamics of the city, I tell you about the Manshiya corridor of Yaffa, the citrus industry, I tell you about the peasant life and the disarmament of the peasants and the 1834 revolt, and I tell you about the 1860s civil wars. If I tell you all of that, could you seriously take at face value the claim that Palestine was an empty land? See, if I just give that foundational education, right? If I deliver that to the Palestinian people, now when you hear these wild claims, you no longer dignify them. And I find that that is a more healthy antidote to, in fact, combating Zionism than responding to their nonsense. It is not out of a fear or a disinterest in the current situation that motivates me to go in this direction. It is, in fact, a deep, seething loathing for Zionism that makes it so uninteresting to me as a topic of research and conversation.
I think that's a really good point. And I think also, it's the issue, as you've said, is that when we counter Hasbara, when we're constantly working on this, not only is Hasbara not ideologically consistent. It's none of it is consistent in any mechanism. It's constantly shifting. Because at the end of the day, Zionists are really only focused on trying to create whatever narrative that might potentially stick in the smallest of fashion with those they're trying to inoculate. And I think it's very interesting. In a lot of ways, we could delve into how that follows a lot of really historical rhetoric that you see espoused by both genocidal actors and fascist actors themselves. This idea that they're victims, they're those that they're colonizing are both simultaneously the most immediate, consistent, and ever-present threat that they could possibly see, but simultaneously some, at best, pestilence that doesn't actually exist in any real fashion, right? This duality of this. And, you know, in the Zionist context, because of this lack of a need to be consistent, you are constantly pushing back on a narrative that within 2 days could be outright reversed, shuffled around, reworked, and pushed forward. You know, I think alongside what you had said, this idea as well that, you know, this Hasbro talking point of making the desert bloom, I think is another really good example, right? Where if you're constantly, and I have for years, constantly pushing back on this narrative that no, in fact, agriculture was a thing before Zionist settlers. Right. And in fact, the early Aliyahs really failed miserably in how they were trying to do their agricultural planning. It's all undercut better by just acknowledging the fact that, like, geographically, Palestine is in the Fertile Crescent. And historically, the agricultural industries within Palestine, whether it be orange groves, whether it be olives, whether it be whatever other industries were existent at the time, were major regional trade, like created major regional trade networks, were notable historically. Like the idea of a Yaffa orange in and of itself is such an integral, you know, thing, not just for Palestinian history, but for the region's commerce. And I think touching on the history means that you don't even have to, I think, acknowledge the propaganda because you just know that it's not true based on the established facts on the ground that have been existent for centuries at a time.
That's exactly correct. But the issue of making the desert bloom is a particularly interesting one. Mm-hmm. So we recently had a case here in British Columbia where our Minister of Higher Education, who was, her name is Selena Robinson, was speaking through Zoom at a B'nai B'rith event of some kind.
Was this the NDP candidate?
Yes.
Yeah.
She was a not just an NDP candidate, she was an NDP cabinet minister,
nice.
Minister of Higher Education. And she said that Palestine was a crappy piece of land. Okay. Now, here's the thing. Putting aside the fact that it's not true, let's say that it was. Let's say that it was a pile of rubble. Let's say that it was a crappy piece of land. That's fine, but it was my pile of shit to do with as I please, right? So now, why was that so important for Zionist propaganda in the 19th and early 20th centuries? And that is because the colonial imagination of land rights at that time mm-hmm. was animated by this belief that God has made us smart and has made them stupid. Us being the colonizer, them being the savages, right? And the natives. And so we have a greater right to their land because we can wield the resources of that land better than they can. Okay, so we see a river and we create hydropower. We see a forest and we create wood-burning fuels. We see coal and we create steam power. The savages see these things and they don't create any of those things. Therefore, it's like a kid with an inheritance who doesn't deserve it. I deserve it. Okay? And this actually reveals the colonial nature of the Zionist movement. I don't spend very much time on my podcast talking about these things yet, because eventually, once I open the can, I'm never going to be able to close it. Once I open the door to speaking about Zionists, it's going to take up my whole life. So I'm putting it off for as long as I can. But that right there is very indicative of how Europeans to this very day view who deserves to be on that land. Strip it all away. Strip away the importance of industrialization. That is to say, let's assume for a moment that there's nothing wrong with living on land that is unindustrialized. And you realize that the claim is super weird, right? Like the idea, okay, so if it was a desert, if it was a desert, were the people unhappy with that desert? First of all, were there people? Did they live there? And then secondly, how did they feel about the place that they lived? And these are things that that of course Zionists never actually speak about because they never bothered to ask them. They didn't even recognize that they were there.
Right.
But it is I've always found that to be a particularly weird claim.
Yeah. It's a combination of the whole like Terra Nullius argument, right? It's this idea that like, oh, there's not any people on it. If there were people on it, which there might have been, then, you know, ultimately, what were they doing anyway? Like, were they just rolling around in the dirt? Like, what, like, you know, we can build farms, we can build industry, we can bring capital to this land, and doing so protect the Suez Canal, which is really a cool little benefit. You know,
it's just a nice, you know? Yes, a nice side benefit. Yeah, there's, in my, I do not recommend to anyone to spend any time debating Zionists.
Absolutely.
I have never come across, and I mean this genuinely, and I've come across a lot, and I've never come across a Zionist who debates in good faith. Mm-hmm. Ever. Ever. So I find it to be rather unconstructive and more accurately, a complete and utter waste of time. But you will find yourself in these little rabbit holes. And what I've discovered in the few conversations that I've allowed myself to have with Zionists that go into this, I've discovered that they don't read very much.
Yeah.
It seems like, and I don't know, I don't claim to be an expert on settler colonialism writ large, but I wonder if it's a constant across other settler societies. Like I try to do some self-reflection on being a settler here in Canada and thinking, is this something consistent for Canadians and Americans and Australians where they don't want to read the history because they don't want to discover the skeletons in their closet? But Zionists are an amplified version of this.
Mm-hmm. Well, in so many ways, I mean, when I think of Zionism, when I look at the project, I look at it as like really fundamentally two things, one being a project out of time, right? Where they began their colonial endeavor well after I think a lot of these colonial endeavors had become something that could be successful in any real facet, right? You speak of like, you know, when you're looking at it historically, like the rise of the so-called United States, the rise of so-called Canada, these were done under really specific material conditions in really specific ages with very specific amounts of backing from imperial powers before any decolonial movement had been really developed in a global scale, as you would have seen in the 60s, for example. Moving into like Zionism, they're trying to take all of these core operational procedures and put them into a period of time in which they're really at the end of what could be considered the era of like direct colonization for the global perspective. But I think also there's, and I think that plays a role in like their ability to be successful, quote unquote, over periods of history. Where you see more of a reaction, I think, more so now, akin to South Africa or akin to the occupation of the north of Ireland, rather than maybe the initial acceptance by Western colonial powers of, say, the colonization of Algeria, which required, or the colonization of Haiti, I think is another really good example. But that's just a small ramble. I think you're right in that. And I think about this a lot, too, as a settler in the United States, is I think that when we look at the colonial narratives, when we look at people who are espousing colonial narratives, people buying into them, I think it, bringing us back to the beginning of our conversation, a lot of in the U.S. context, it's an institutionalized lack of knowledge where every bit of information we're learning is very much geared towards this idea of like American exceptionalism and American innocence. This kind of sword and shield of the project. And in trying to defend our actions, rationalize the actions, or outright ignore them, a lot of Americans don't recognize the history and the violence that went into the land acquisition and the land theft and the genocides that went through itself, right? You know, a lot of Americans can tell you what state or city they live in. sometimes even states and cities that are named after indigenous names for the areas, but can't tell you the tribes that used to inhabit the land itself. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons for that. I think settler colonies, like the end goal is the elimination of natives in all forms but nostalgia, right? Eliminating not only the existence of natives on the land, but also the very memory of them ever having existed on the land. And Zionists, I think we see this amplification because the solvency of their project in the absence of being able to eliminate Palestinians outright, because they just can't and haven't been able to for myriad reasons, is they're trying their best to just ignore the reality of Palestine, right? They do their best to kind of like, it's like if you're driving and you were to just like put a blindfold on in the midst of driving your car, like you're going to crash a lot. Nothing you do will make any sense, but you will still be driving the car. And I think, you know, that's the way I look at Zionists. I agree with you though. It's funnier too, because even the Zionists who are well-read, Zionist academics like Benny Morris comes to mind. Even when they're doing their own research, the amount of mental gymnastics they have to do to then justify the history in which they're uncovering is really, I think, fascinating and telling. Like Benny Morris was one of the first Israeli historians, at least, to put forth this idea of mass displacement during the Nakba, for example, which was revolutionary in Israeli circles, but something that anyone else probably could have told you outside of the project. And he was shunned, criticized, what have you for it. And he moves years later to a position of, yes, these things happened, but they sort of had to happen. And if anything, it's good that they happened, and we probably should have done it more. Which is, I think, in my opinion, way more evil than simple colonial ignorance. But nonetheless, I think it really speaks to the kind of psyche that's required to buy into these colonial narratives. And Americans do the same thing. We're like, yeah, like that happened, but you know, we gave them fair trade.
Look at all this awesome stuff that we have,
like,
now, right?
Man, yeah. Destiny, man. Like we can get from California to New York. What, you know, and it's, I think that in and of itself is an interesting conversation to be had over like how these colonial narratives seek. You know, Hasbara is interesting in that not only is it creating a new narrative, but it's actively trying to combat against the potential inoculation of Palestinian history, where like they're trying to jump to topics. I'm sorry,
I'm enjoying this. No, this is great. And this is why I started following your TikToks in the first place before I actually ever met you. So, like I said earlier, I generally do not find Zionists and Zionism to be even on an intellectual level, like to be interesting subjects.
Very boring. Very boring. Right.
But when I focus on Zionism, I try my best to think about the things that make Zionism distinct, the things that make them unique. And there are a few things here that do stand out. One is Zionism's ability to morph with the times. So you said earlier that Zionism is kind of out of step and it's against the grain, right? It is a settler colonial movement. It is clearly a settler colonial movement in an era where settler colonial movements are dying. And colonialism is a dirty word. We don't do anything about it, but it's a
right. We don't like to acknowledge it, though.
No. Yeah. Or in fact, the only thing we do is acknowledge it. Like that we don't go any further than acknowledging it. Within the 1940s, the Zionists were already rebranding as a national liberation movement, and then were rebranding again as an indigenous rights movement, right? Things that would have made Zeev Jabotinsky roll in his grave. The idea that us and the Mizrahi are this like one, in this like one native struggle against imperial powers, would absolutely have made no sense to him. And I have, you know, like interesting anecdotes from the Ottoman era, but when the Zionists first began settling, they lobbied the Ottoman government to ensure that legally it is enshrined that they and the indigenous Jews were not the same millet, not the same nation. They said, we are distinct from these savages. Like even their fellow Jews, they wanted them, and that's in Michelle Campos talks about this in her book, Ottoman Brothers. So this is one thing that the Zionists have done quite well, is they will continue rebranding with the times. paralleled with that are two tactics, let's call them. One is righteous fury. And that is a genuine, and I really, for most of my life, I believed this was performative, but I no longer believe that it's performative. It is a genuine insanity that occurs at the faintest challenge of their truths, right, of their narratives, and a feeling of existential panic at having anything that you've said meet any form of resistance. One anecdote that I liked it, oh, this was, I believe, in a book by Lewis Fishman. I can't remember the name of the book now, but I'll share it with you after. Recently published in like 2021, 2022. And he tells a story about, I believe it was in this book, so I apologize to the listeners if they don't end up finding it there. But he tells a story about what was basically a bar fight between Jews and Palestinians in like 1906, 1907. So two drunken idiots get in a fight. There's like two dead here, three dead here. The police have to break it up. And there is a Hebrew and Ladino press, and there is an Arabic press. In the Arabic Ottoman press, it is recorded as basically what I said. It's a bar fight, a couple idiots. This is what happened. It was a big fight. Five people die in a fight. That's a big deal. In the Hebrew press, it was a pogrom. Right. Now, no sane person would refer to this as a pogrom, and yet they did. And the fury that with which they confront having those accusations challenged is I think distinctly Zionist. I really don't think there are another group of people who respond with that level of panic. But paired with that is what I call the weaponization of unreasonable doubt. So in our respective legal systems on both sides of our borders, we believe in innocence or guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And we say a reasonable doubt. This legal term has a meaning. Reasonable doubt is there because unreasonable doubt is endless. So if I see James recorded having murdered someone and I get the video recording and you say, no, it wasn't me. Somebody that looks like me traveled from an alternate universe and killed this person. Is that philosophically possible? Maybe. Is it a reasonable assumption? No. Right? Okay. So that's what it means to have reasonable doubt. Unreasonable doubt is to have thousands upon thousands upon thousands of videos of Palestinians being mercilessly murdered. Most recently, we have drone footage of unarmed Palestinians being obliterated from the sky, and you are forced to accept as a counter-narrative the idea that these were combatants that were actively engaged in some act of legitimate or illegitimate armed resistance. I posted that video on my Instagram, and a Zionist posted, you can clearly see that they were carrying explosives. You can't, right? You cannot. Your eyes are telling you that that's not what's happening, but they will weaponize unreasonable doubt and then back it up with righteous fury when it is challenged. And that is mind-numbing, right? It's enough to drive you insane, which is a large part of why I've chosen to spend most of my time doing something else. They are just not worth it. They're not worth it.
That makes sense. I mean, I guess kind of like as we begin to get towards wrapping up, you know, when you're looking at like the third season, potentially a fourth season down the line, what are some more topics that you haven't quite touched yet that you think would be things you might dive into?
Oh, fantastic question. I have about six episodes in the pipeline right now As I alluded to earlier, some of them deal directly with the Bedouins and the way that, and looking at things from their perspective. Tangentially related to that, and again, I did not plan this. It's just kind of the way that the story flowed, is I want to spend a lot of time speaking about the impact that the Damascus to Hejaz Railway had on the development of Palestine and the infrastructural projects such as the telegraph lines and the way that that changed Palestinian life. In addition to that, I plan on doing several deep dives into Palestinian towns and the internal dynamics that emerged in each one of these towns. I want to do another revisit of Palestinian villages in the Hamidian era. And then I want to tie all of this together in thinking about how the various stories that I've told, the stories of towns, the stories of the villagers, the stories of the Bedouins, the stories of the infrastructural project, how they all tie together in a shared experience that crosses these class boundaries.
I think those are really, really interesting concepts. You're covering a lot.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. You know, I have to say there is an Islamic concept of barakah, which means blessing, I guess. And barakah is kind of thought of as a time and wealth and nutrient multiplier.
Mm-hmm.
So there is barakah in Ramadan. And the proof of that is that I think I've finished my fourth book this Ramadan, third or fourth book, so which is like a reading pace beyond what I usually what I usually accomplish, and so yes, it's a lot to cover, but inshallah I'll be able to get through it.
Inshallah, I mean it'll be very interesting. I mean, well, you still have time for a fifth book this Ramadan.
I still have time. Yes, I'm on it. I'm on it.
Got just enough days. You can.
I'm on it. No, I
short read.
It does help to enjoy what you do.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't enjoy what you do, it makes everything more difficult.
Very fair. I mean, so I get, again, before we end up, do you have any like book recommendations for any viewers who might find?
Oh my God, so many. Okay, yeah. So my answer is yes.
Okay,
but I recently made a post on Instagram of book recommendations to suggest to your local library. And there I put 40 books, something like 40, 42 or 39. I can't remember exactly the number, but a whole bunch of books. And I've, to the best of my memory, I've even categorized them in terms of whether you're looking at Palestinian families or if you're more interested in specific towns or specific people, biographies. So you can find me on Instagram at Preoccupation Pod, and that will you'll be able to find that there. If you're not on Instagram, you could find my podcast. It is called Preoccupation and Not So Brief History of Palestine, and there I'm referring to different books all the time. So I will say this as a final note: it always helps to know the question you want to ask, and then I can find the book that you're looking for. That's the formula that I found to produce the greatest amount of success.
No, I think that's very fair. Well, I'm hoping that people who do get a chance to, I think, get in touch with you and find some of these resources have at least a couple of questions in mind when they're looking through this list. I'm definitely going to have to stop myself from going through and just buying all 40 of these books.
Oh, dude, they're so expensive. They're so,
I know.
So expensive.
Okay, as a side note, that is the most frustrating bit of looking at like historical books and things is I will find something where I'm like, I need this. And it's like, oh, it's $200?
Yes.
Great.
Yeah. I wish I chose a more affordable habit like cocaine or something more affordable, but unfortunately, this is my.
Yeah, so. No, I just as a small aside, I remember the first time I bought a book that was more than like $20. I was like, "This is crazy! Don't know how I'm doing this." It was like the collected works of Tetaki Yatanke, so like Sitting Bull, and it was like his collected speeches and analysis historically. I mean, it was like $60, and I was like, "This is crazy! I'm breaking the bank for this."
Yeah,
and then I started diving into Palestinian history pre-36, and I was like, "Oh, awesome."
Carl, like $200. Yeah.
Yeah, Got it. Which is why I'm glad to have your podcast to summarize a lot of what I would otherwise be reading. I know my fiance and I both very much appreciate the fact that I am not spending that amount of money on literature.
No, if I can do it, if I could do it for you, I'm glad. Yeah.
But yeah, okay. Well, to that end, this has been another episode of Guerrilla Radio with me, James, as your host. As always, you can find us all over social media, not just with Guerrilla Radio, but also Guerrilla History, our parent podcast. I would be remiss if I didn't also suggest listening to Rev Left Radio, as well as the Red Menace podcast, all sister podcasts, this established little family of podcasts at this point. Bassem, if you want to go through and just one real quick, go through all the social media handles you might want us to follow, anything other relevant. I know you just did a minute ago, but just to reiterate it for people who skipped to the very end for the resources.
Yeah, no problem. So thank you so much for having me. And you can find me on Instagram at Preoccupation Pod. The podcast is called Preoccupation, a Not-So-Brief History of Palestine. It is on Spotify, Apple Podcast, basically everywhere that you listen to podcasts, you'll find it there. James, thank you so much.
Of course.
Always a pleasure.
Plexiglass and styrofoam. You want it more than a model home. Every week we plan our escape.
Fuck with autumn for the changes. My family is the foliage, the branches for the nameless. My roots as deep as holiest. I console the mothers who saw the streets as fathers, to raise a wild few who ended up amongst the scholars. Yeah, that's why I'm praying for our daughters, so they can lead us through these waters. Cause when mama's proud, she's the grace that we charter. Ambition is akin to intuition.
Saturdays, with your mind on empty, spirit on extra, body on me. Won't buy what the soul can't see. Won't touch what the heart can't read. Waiting for a cold case of basics. They just wanna see if we'll make it. Same answers, new faces. Circles round these places. Plexiglass and some styrofoam. You want it more than a model home. Every week we plan our escape.